I'm Betsy Bykoff, Vice President and Chief Grantmaking Officer of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation in Indianapolis, Indiana. You're in for a treat this morning because we have representatives from four outstanding organizations from around the country who will be talking about proven programs that are truly making a difference in the lives of people in Houston, Indianapolis, Philadelphia, and Salt Lake City. This panel discussion is a continuation of the Philanthropy Roundtable's year-long program known as the Economic Opportunity Road Tour that has spotlighted highly successful nonprofits around the country that have demonstrated sustainable solutions to helping individuals reclaim their lives. Some of you in the audience today may have funded programs like this before. Some may be new to this area of interest. I understand donors who have attended the road tour programs have expressed that they were surprised to be funding in this area and were doing so because of the economy. It is certainly a difficult time for many people in all of our communities. Our panelists today will be sharing with you how their respective social service organizations have approached the issues of homelessness, providing support services, character building, training, employment services, transitional and permanent housing, as well as repurposing unused food through a job training program. The locations are different, and the solutions vary, although there are some common themes. At the end of our session today, we'll identify what those common themes are. Each of our panelists will talk for about 10 minutes and give an overview of their organization, what the true impact of their work has been, and we will also, they will be sharing with you some of the common themes as well as the work that they have done and what they think are the most important takeaways from today's discussion that you as donors and funders can use in your own communities. We will have ample time after they've given their overviews for questions. I'd like to introduce our panelists, and it's starting from my far left. And I won't give you their full bios because they're in the programs, but I'll give you just a few highlights. Barbara Elliott is the founder of the Center for Cultural Renewal, a research center she founded in 1997 for faith-based organizations working to renew the cities of America. In 2007, she founded the Work Faith Connection in Houston, Texas, which serves people leaving homelessness, prison, drug addiction, and joblessness. Barbara has had a distinguished career in academia, journalism, and has authored two books. She has received many awards, and next week she will be recognized again, or she will be recognized by the Manhattan Institute with yet another award for her work as a social entrepreneur. Today, Barbara will be talking about the work-faith connection. Seated to her right, is our next panelist is Sister Mary Scullion, Executive Director and President of Project Home in Philadelphia. In 1989, Sister Mary co-founded Project Home along with Joan Dawson McConnon, which has become a nationally recognized organization providing solutions to break the cycle of homelessness and poverty through a variety of programs ranging from supportive housing, employment, education, and health care. She is also a powerful voice in political issues affecting homelessness and mentally ill persons. In 2009, Sister Mary was named by Time magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people. Jennifer Vigren is CEO of Second Helpings, an organization in Indianapolis that was founded 13 years ago to eliminate hunger and empower people in Indianapolis. It, too, is an award-winning nonprofit, having received the Best of the Best Indiana Achievement Award that recognized the best nonprofits in Indiana over a 10-year period. Jennifer's background is a labor relations and human resources professional, consultant, and board volunteer gave her a unique perspective on how to lead Second Helpings, which uses food that would otherwise end up in landfills to prepare meals for agencies to distribute to hungry families in the community, and also serves as the basis for a successful job culinary training program for homeless and at-risk adults. Our fourth panelist will be Matt Menkovich, Executive Director of The Road Home, which operates the Family Self-Sufficiency and Homeless Shelter in Salt Lake City and a winter shelter in Midville, Utah. The Road Home also has permanent supportive apartments for chronically homeless people. Matt and the Road Home, similar to his fellow panelists, have received many awards, including Matt received Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year Award in 2009. In researching Matt's background, I found an interesting quote from the Salt Lake City Chief of Police, who told a local newspaper after a study was conducted showing the positive impact of Road Home's supportive apartments that, I quote, "We can't arrest our way out of social problems like homelessness and drug addiction." The article ended by saying the Road Home is a cost-effective, simple solution to a chronic problem. That's real entrepreneurship. With that lead-in about finding solutions to chronic problems, let's hear from our four experts on how they are doing it in their respective cities. Let's start with Barbara.
I am here as the founder of the Work Faith Connection. Our mission, as you can see, is helping people in transition build a new life through faith and work. Our name isn't an accident. We believe that the two actually are very closely related. And the kind of people who are in transition from all kinds of things. We help them get ready to find a job and provide them the kind of skills that they're going to need to apply successfully, but also that a network of relationships that will allow them to not just get a job, which is not as hard, but keep a job, which is much harder, particularly if you have things in your life history that have made you unstable for whatever reason. So we help provide them a network of relationships that will continue with them, starting with our own organization, but then lots of other partners in the community as well. We walk with them for the first full year that they're on the job and then help them advance after that for the second and third and however many years it takes. But these are some of the folks who are on their way out of whatever it was that had brought them down, and they are finding a productive life. The kind of folks that we are including in our program are some of the people that we were advised never to take. People with felonies in their background. 60% of our folks have felonies. Another 17 beyond that have Class B or C misdemeanors. So if you can imagine putting an online application pretty much anywhere and you have to check the felony box, of course you don't get called back for the interview. So people who are in that situation, if they tell the truth, have a very hard time. So we've made it a point to accept those. You don't have to be a felon to get in our program, don't get me wrong. But if you do have that in your background, or drug or alcohol abuse or whatever it might be, that's all right. We say, come on in, we'll find a place where you can fit. It's been interesting, though, because when people have those kinds of things in their past, they need a little bit more intensive care to become stable and to learn whole new patterns of life. We do things in four phases, and the first phase is simply a job readiness workshop. We interview people on the way in to ascertain, do you actually want to work? We partnered with a number of community organizations, including a homeless shelter that has a transitional living program, a couple prison programs that are faith-based that, you know, when they get out, then you can pick them up. Chuck Colson's program is one of them. But we have to know, do you actually want to work? Because we found after we'd crunched the numbers a couple years into it, not everybody did. So we asked them that question. Then we help them reconstruct just an accurate job history. And in creative ways, you know, if you were in prison, you actually worked for the state of Texas in that time. So, you know, there are ways to, seriously, you know, there are ways to do that more positively. We also then do a lot of attitude changing. We talk to them a lot about attitude, and we found that the one thing that distinguishes the people who will succeed is that they have an attitude of gratitude. And that's one of the questions coming in. Is there anything in your life that you're grateful for? And if they have that somewhere, it means they have the capacity to at least hope and potentially also to love. And both of those are very important. We emphasize a lot of personal responsibility and just teach them basic things about how to respond to difficult situations and, you know, anger management sorts of things. But a lot of it is basically talking about who are you, you know, what is your purpose in life, and how does work fit into that purpose for which you've been created? We believe work is a gift from God, and they're allowed to participate in His creation in that way. We strengthen them in their faith along the way, but we're also giving them very practical, you know, HR drills and how to do a job interview. They go through several mock interviews beforehand. They have a 30-second elevator speech that they can give about who they are and what their capabilities are. And by the time they get through the 8 days, they're feeling pretty good about themselves. David Meadows, to the right there, is the person who initiated our training. He'd spent the previous 15 years of his career in career transition. So people who had just been let go from a major company, he would be the guy in the next room who would essentially meet them and help them then go through the job search. Well, he took all of that skill for the white-collar sector, and he didn't dumb down the curriculum at all. He just added a few things, like how to talk about felonies. But it's exactly the same professional training that he gave all of those years very successfully to other people. We present our students with a certificate at the end of the the 8-day program, and some of them say that's the first time I've ever finished anything. So we celebrate it in a big way. They go into the next phase after that. We call it pipeline to payday. They get a job coach. The two down in the front there, that's Frida and Jeff, both of whom graduated from our program. They then meet with everybody who's in job search once a week face-to-face and phone with them more often than that, and they have a little chart that they fill out with the things that they've completed. How many interviews did you schedule? How many did you go to? How many offers did you get? What happened with them? Kind of keep them accountable. Usually takes 3 or 4 months. Since the economy got worse, it's 3 or 4 months. Before that, it was a little faster. The next phase is then stabilization on the job, because we found that getting the job is not the hard part. Keeping it is. We make them promise that they will not quit without calling us. They actually have to sign something, you know, don't quit without calling. And then phase four is if they've been on the year for one, been on the job for 1 year, we help them advance. Because the whole point is to lift them out of poverty or near poverty to the point that they are earning 200% of the poverty rate in a job with health insurance. That's our goal for them. But they have to stabilize first. And they are. And they are working for people all over the city. We've graduated 1,416 people since our first class in January of 2007. 78% of them have jobs and are working now. That's those that we know about. Some people just take the class and then leave and don't stay in touch, so it's probably higher than that, but we're being conservative on the numbers. They're working for 450 different employers around Houston, all different kinds of jobs. The starting wage is a little above $10 an hour, and some of them are earning more money than I do right now, so they've done very, very well. And we're finding that they are happy to get off public assistance. Some of them said it was the happiest day of my life to not have food stamps anymore. They're paying child support. They're getting back in touch with their families. We're seeing a ripple effect that goes to many, many more people. So why does it work? I think part of the secret is that we have a genuine blend of corporate knowledge, i.e. David Meadows, who started the program with that background, and now we have two locations, so somebody else with a similar background. Sandy Schultz, to the right there, came from the corporate sector. She ran a company herself that grew from 5 employees to 140, so she knows how to do that. Deborah Howard, to the left there, is on our board. She did HR for grocery stores all over the Houston region. So we have people who know the corporate world, but we also have the nonprofit side, and that matters. We also have the street smarts side. This is Scott Wesley. His mugshot to the left is the day that he was arrested. He was a meth cook and had been basically evading the law for quite some time. A judge said, if I could send you to prison any longer than I can, I would. He came to our program 3 weeks after he got out of prison. And he now works for us. We hired him the week after he graduated. A little scary. It was the first felon we'd hired. And he's one of the best employees because he's so grateful to have a different life. And he could interface with the people coming through the program in a way that we can't. He can say, look, you can do it. And yes, I know what it's like to be in prison. And yes, I know what it's like to have lost custody of my kids. About a third of our employees came through the program. So we have the kind of street smarts aspect as well. The result is transformed lives. During the graduation ceremony, we have them put on two sides of a piece of cardboard where they were at the point in their life when they were farthest from joy, farthest from hope, farthest from God. And then on the other side, where are you today? So Some of the things that come out of that, they have new attributes. They're patient. They're honest. They're focused. They have a closer relationship with God. They have a transformed life. They're at least launched in a new direction. And if they can keep that trajectory for the next year with all of us wrapped around them and all the community partners, then they do make a difference. The faith factor is significant. You can read his sign. I wrote it out because I thought it might be a little difficult. Here's one who says he was a stubborn, functioning alcoholic, and now he's a renewed creature of God. That's the success story. The kind of transition that most of our people make, they couldn't do without God's help. To stay sober and to keep getting up and going to work and to keep hanging in there when all of your friends were absolutely disastrous for you, that takes God's help. And we strengthen them in that. If they're willing to go there, we strengthen it. If they don't want to, that's fine too. We'll just love them anyway. And the love is the last factor. We do a lot of hugging. So at every graduation, I get to hug every single graduate. Now, I will tell you in this audience, I haven't hugged so many felons since I worked in Washington. We like to share the love, and they keep coming back for the hugs, and I think love makes all the difference. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sister Mary Scullion. I'm a Sister of Mercy from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's great to be here with you. And I'm going to talk about the work of Project Home. I belong to a community of people from all walks of life that are committed to ending homelessness and poverty in Philadelphia. We started in 1989 in the locker room of a swimming pool, really a volunteer effort to work with people that were living on the streets. That was our base, people that were chronically homeless. And over the past 22 years, when we were in the locker room of a swimming pool, the Conley Foundation came and visited us and gave us a check for $100,000 with no strings attached and said, see what you can do with this. That was their challenge to us in 1989. And over the past 22 years, we have developed about 500 units of housing. We have HOME, H is housing, O is opportunities for employment. We have three social businesses. We have the Homepage Cafe in the Free Library of Philadelphia on the Parkway, partnership with Starbucks and Metropolitan Bakery. We have our Daily Threads thrift store. And we have a couple of social entrepreneurial businesses that the people themselves own, but it comes under our social enterprises. We have employment services. We work with Exelon Corporation, which does just a phenomenal job. They allow us to have internships. So exactly what Barbara was talking about, many of the men and women that are homeless. And of course, we all know that homelessness is symptomatic of some deeper societal problems. It's not a problem in and of itself. But through Exelon, we're able to place men and women that were homeless living on the streets. Many of them are veterans, and into paid internships. So we have people that work at PICO, people that work at the visitor center, people that work in law firms, and they work there 20 hours a week, and then the other time they do many of the educational and soft skills training at Project Home, and then eventually get a job. You know, and again, we continue to support them in that effort. M is medical care. We have a free health clinic with Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where people can come, whether they have insurance or don't have insurance, whatever. People that are chronically homeless, I think that one of the things that I can safely say, what's the difference from 1989 when we first started Project Home till now? And that is in 1989, many of the men and women who live on the street were seriously mentally ill, you know, seriously actively addicted, combination of both, and some with physical challenges. Today, many more people have very serious medical issues, and that whole medical component is a really important factor in enabling people to break the cycle of homelessness as well as prevent homelessness. E-education, we have a state-of-the-art technology center in the heart of a very, very low-income neighborhood, and we have after-school programs K through 12th, college access program. We have a program for grandmothers who are raising their kids in the neighborhood to help support them. We have adult learning programs, including a partnership with Community College in Philadelphia, because, again, the single most important thing to ending homelessness today is affordable housing. The single most important thing to ending homelessness in the future is a quality education for every single child. And so we really work both short-term and long-term efforts to end homelessness in our city. In our education effort, too, we have a partnership with Germantown Academy. It's a very prestigious independent school in Philadelphia, and actually in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And we partner with them, and they run a small independent school for the talented 10th, right in our technology center that is unbelievable. It's just amazing. And again, education is the ticket out. In our college access program, we have 30 of our kids that are in college right now that we are so proud of. And they'll be our future leaders. Ending homelessness, HOME, housing, education, employment, and medical care, short-term solutions. So today we have 24 hours. We can make a difference. There's things that we can all do to address the short-term needs. But we have to be strategic and think about long-term efforts. So we have an effort to prevent homelessness. We have 17 different locations throughout Philadelphia, and I'm sure you've all experienced NIMBY if you've done anything in the area of trying to develop affordable housing for people with special needs that are homeless. But we, in a neighborhood that we have a residence in, a very, very poor neighborhood, people in the neighborhood said, look at us. This neighborhood is the largest producer of people that are homeless in our city. It was done by Dennis Culhane, University of Pennsylvania, did a study, what neighborhoods are producing the largest amount of people into the shelter system. So we partnered with this neighborhood to prevent homelessness. How did we do it? The same thing. Affordable housing, opportunities for employment, medical care, and education. Our free health clinics is in that neighborhood, as well as our school and technology center. Feeding the hungry, sheltering the homeless, visiting the sick is not as simple as one would think. At Project Home, we have 11 limited partnerships and 4 nonprofits. We have about 250 employees. Many of them are part-time, but we do affirmatively hire from our residents and within the community. So we, too, have well over 30% of our employees once were homeless. We have people that were homeless that now have master's degrees. But, again, there's no quick fixes in this. It doesn't happen in a day. It doesn't even happen in 6 weeks. It doesn't even happen in a year. It's a sustained effort, and it's all about the power of relationships. These are the concrete things we do, but the way we do it is really important, and that is about the sense of community. Our mission statement and our vision statement is none of us are home until all of us are home. Not only are men and women that we work with transformed, but we're transformed. I'm ruined for life. I will never be the same having worked with the men and women that I've worked with before. And I can honestly say that's what many of our staff, volunteers, and donors feel at Project Home. When we're engaged and we're touching some of the most vulnerable and such serious suffering, we're all transformed from that. And that's why we undertake our work not only in the spirit of community, but we undertake our work through political advocacy. We are very involved. We have a class action suit for fair housing in our city that we won through the United States Department of Justice represented us, and we won that. We've sued the city of Philadelphia police a couple times for illegally arresting homeless people, and we've also, won those lawsuits. I only have one more minute left. In undertaking our work, in addition to really working very closely with the men and women that we serve, we also have to develop an infrastructure. Like, it's really important to build your organization as well as to address the needs. We have one of the really outstanding things that I'm so proud of is we have a robust alumni program. So many of the men and women that were once seriously mentally ill, living on the street, are now living in their own apartments and working and voting and caring for their families. what up here is saving lives, saving monies. The study's in the back, but obviously it's common sense. If you are paying for court costs, prison costs, shelter costs, ER costs, it's much more inexpensive to put people to house, educate, heal, and employ people, because then they become the future taxpayers. My time's up. I can't say anything more, except if you want to, we can, you know, I'm happy to talk afterwards.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Jennifer Vigren, and I'm the CEO of Second Helpings, which is a program in Indianapolis that has three programs. We're a food rescue organization, we're a hunger relief organization, and we also have a culinary job training program. Now, I always have to start and explain what food rescue is and what it isn't. It is not dumpster diving. When we talk about food rescue in our organization, we're talking about rescuing overstocked, overprepared, and perishable food. Most of our food comes from retailers and wholesalers who are sending us food that is nearing expiration and is perfectly good product. You heard Betsy describe earlier that that is the food that we use in our culinary job training program. Our culinary job training program lasts for 10 weeks. It's provided free of charge to all of our students. We are all clearly dealing with the very same population, people who are underemployed, unemployed, people who are traditionally considered unemployable. Many of our students are homeless, but not all of them, but many of them have a history of domestic violence, substance abuse, incarceration, very same kinds of profiles that you're hearing about this morning. Why culinary training? Well, first of all, we do have this asset of having the food available to us, and we have people who are working in our organization who are involved in the culinary industry. But frankly, it's a field that's always looking to hire. Even in the depths of the recession, we were still successful in placing our students. Were there quite as many jobs? No. But certainly there are still jobs available to them, because there are always people in this industry looking for trained employees with good salad skills. But it's more than that. In the culinary industry, we also know that nobody cares whether or not you have a diploma or a GED or where you went to college. It's about what you can do and how you can produce today. And the limits on our students' careers are endless. They can do as much as they are personally capable of, regardless of their personal history. And, of course, it's also a life skill. We know that when our students leave our program, they've not only learned to cook, but they've also learned to feed their families. They've learned how to cook inexpensively, effectively, and healthfully. So at the very least, they will have a skill that will last them and their families a lifetime. Of course, all of our students come to us with barriers. You've heard about them before. And these are our students on day one. They come into our classroom, and often very nervous about what's before them, uncertain about their futures. I've had students tell me that every day they needed a pep talk, and they went to their sponsors or they went to their family, and every day they needed that support to tell them, yes, you could get through, because day after day there were the self-doubts in their minds. We work with a lot of partner agencies, but I have to tell you that what we have found is that the students who actually come out of homelessness, the students who are in shelters, often perform the best in this program, because every single day the people surrounding them are constantly cheering them on and telling them they can do it. Their entire lives are built around being successful in this program. That's not true of our students who are living independently. Many of them have to go home to dealing with childcare challenges, dealing with spouse issues, dealing with day-to-day survival, and dealing with the same people who perhaps have been tearing them down instead of building them up over the years. We rely very heavily on guest chefs. We are very grateful to the chef community, from the restaurants to the hotels. This gentleman right here actually is the director of our local culinary school. And he and his staff and his students all come in and volunteer in our program and serve as guest instructors. Those guest instructors give our students exposure to different chef styles, because as you know, chefs all have very different personalities and styles. So they need to be ready when they're dealing with a very soft-spoken chef who will only tell them something once, or a very animated chef who, when they get yelled at for the first time, they're not going to faint and fall on the floor and run out of the room. We try to make sure they're exposed to every style and give them as realistic a job experience as possible. Of course, we know that our students need far more than just knife skills and cooking skills. They need a lot of life skills support. And we have in-house a case management service available to our students. We have a case manager who works on them with them for whatever barriers they may encounter, and we work very closely with partner agencies throughout our entire community. We don't pretend that we can solve all the problems ourselves or that we can offer all of the services ourselves. We turn to Harris Bank that provides financial literacy training for our students. For many of them, the day they walk into the bank for their first class is the first time they have ever walked into a bank. And when they complete that program, regardless of their personal history, they've learned about credit scores, they've learned about different accounts, and the bank offers them the opportunity to open their first account. We work with Dress for Success and other organizations in the community. We also turn to our corporate and other volunteers who bring us their various talents to help our students with all sorts of workplace readiness skills, whether it is stress management, whether it is working in teams, whether it is resumes, interviews, all of those things. We try to use the entire resources of our community and not duplicate the resources when we don't have to. If there's a secret ingredient to our program, it's this man right here. Chef Sam Brown is himself a graduate of this program. He graduated from the program in 1999, and he has walked exactly where every one of our students has been. Without going into his own personal history, I can just tell you that since his graduation, Sam has become an award-winning chef. He has studied at the Cordon Bleu in Ottawa, Canada. He's been an executive chef. He not only knows where these students have been, but he knows where they can go. And time and time again, I have had graduates tell me that the thing that kept them going each day was knowing that he had been where they had been, and that it really not only was possible, it was personally achievable. Sam doesn't do it all himself, though. I mentioned that we have guest chefs, but he also calls upon fellow graduates to come in as guest instructors, to come in as mentors, to come in and speak to our students and encourage them on a day-to-day basis. Upon graduation, our students leave us with a toolkit of certifications in safe food handling, in first aid, in CPR, all of the various things we know they're going to need in the workplace. And they also have the equivalent of 6 credit hours at the local culinary school should they wish to continue their education. Graduations certainly mark a major milestone for families. We have parents show up and grandparents show up with cameras to capture the moment when they saw their adult child finish something, often for the first time in their lives. It's often also a reunion. I have seen adult children walk into graduation to be there for a parent they have not seen in many, many years. In those instances, it's an opportunity for a family to begin healing and to repair damaged lives. As our chef reminds me, each time that one of our students gets a job, it's not just impacting that individual's future career, it's also helping to break the cycle of poverty for an entire family. There are many things that make our program successful. It is the partnerships throughout our community. We have no federal grants. We rely entirely on our community for funding, whether it is the individual donors who make up most of our funding or the community foundations and the United Way and the corporate sponsors who support us. But it goes, as I mentioned earlier, it goes beyond funding. They provide us a great number of services to make our program successful. I'd like to end by telling you about one of our graduates. His name is Sunil. And Sunil was recently selected as one of the 46 faces of the Super Bowl for 2012 to represent our city. And when he came in and shared this with me, I congratulated him. And he pulled me aside and he said, yes, but you have to remember that 3 years ago, I was just a drunk living under the bridge right around the corner. I saw Sunil actually right before I came here a couple days ago. And he was rushing into the room and wanted to introduce me to the young man he had in tow. And this young man was a little scruffy, and his clothes didn't quite fit him right, but his eyes were bright. And Sunil said, introduced me and said this gentleman was from the same shelter that Sunil had been staying in when he was in our program. And he just said, I'm bringing him here to meet Chef because he needs to be in the next class. Thank you.
Thanks to each of you for being here this morning. I'm Matt Minkovich, and I have the privilege of serving as a member of the team at The Road Home. And our agency exists to help people to overcome homelessness. And rather similar to Sister Mary's programs, The Road Home has started to tailor our services to help people, specifically those who are living in the sheltering system as their permanent housing destination, to overcome homelessness. I'm going to dial back the calendar about a decade. When I was first working at the shelter, we were serving about 2,500 people annually. On any given night, we were just under 500 people. That's single men, single women, families with children. We're the state's largest shelter at this time, and to this day, we maintain that. At that point in time, we had about 306 people housed nightly. Although our record keeping in that area is not as reliable as it is today, I think that that's the most ambitious count of people we would have in housing. We were really a shelter-focused model. And we had a small team of case managers who were working to help the people who had come into the shelter become housing ready before they left the shelter. And upon leaving the shelter, we had two case managers who would help families mainly transition out of shelter and into housing and maintain that relationship out in the housing, out in community housing. And we saw that there was a great room for improvement in this area. So with what Sister has already described regarding the specifics of the program, I want to show you the results that you can have when you employ her thoughtful model. We learned, Sister mentioned Dr. Culhane out of the University of Pennsylvania. About this time, 2001, he had come out with research where he had studied shelter consumption patterns, I believe in New York and Philadelphia. And what he found there was that about 90% of people experiencing homelessness in those metropolitan areas were having a brief episode of homelessness, moving out of homelessness rather quickly, and back into housing. But this small segment of humanity, about 10%, of the population experiencing homelessness, had turned to the emergency shelter system as their permanent housing destination. They had nowhere else to go for a variety of different reasons contributing to that. Well, that just sounded strange to us in Salt Lake City and among my team. We thought that percentage of people experiencing chronic homelessness has to be higher because our shelter is filled on any given night with people who kind of fit that description. So we started to do our own research to see, or just comparing our database against Dr. Culhane's research, and we found he was right, that there are about 10% of those who are coming to our shelter who are living there. And that's characterized in the first group as Group B. We found about 12%. Now, we looked through 2006 to 2011. We actually did research earlier than this, but this is more up to date. Now, Group B, if you go to the next pie there, that shows the number of shelter nights they're consuming on average and their footprint on the shelter. So 12% of the people coming to us are consuming about 60% of all of our available beds. And when we looked at that, we thought, that's indicative of something. There's not a housing alternative that makes sense for that small segment of humanity. The affordable housing market in its current form is somewhat successful at reaching out to the other 88% who are coming to us in need of shelter, but is bypassing that 12%. And that's rather understandable. A landlord would be hard-pressed to rent an apartment to some of the gentlemen who are staying with us who have no income, who have a variety of personal problems, health-related, certainly mental health, substance abuse or alcoholism. There's a lot of reasons that it doesn't add up on a landlord's ledger to bring an individual in that category into housing. So we work to create a model that would accommodate individuals in that area and to see if we could get a better result. Now, this chart shows a breakdown of four different categories of people staying in our shelter system, and the bottom here represents all of the shelter beds we're providing on a given night, on average just under 700. What really struck us is that 38% of everyone who was coming to us over the last 5 years stayed a week, 7 nights or fewer in our sheltering system, and consumed as few as 9 beds on a daily basis. So with as many as 63 beds, we can serve over half of the total population coming to us in need of shelter. We started to realize that shelters don't have to be as big in urban America as they currently are. They're inflamed, and we need to create an antidote. And that antidote is affordable housing with supportive services. So we became, over the course of this last decade, a housing-focused agency. It was not easy to do. There were internally, there was a lot of resistance. I had case managers that were just not getting it. And coming back, I don't understand. I don't understand where you're coming from to management. Finally, I remember in a little bout of frustration with my case managers, I posed the question, where would you rather work on your personal problems? Where would you rather work on your personal problems? In the privacy of your own home? Or among 690 other people in a congregate shelter setting? Of course this is a stressful environment. Of course we can create something better. Of course we can help move people into housing more quickly. There are models out there. And provide services therein. And let's see how people fare. It's worth a shot. At that point in time, we had not factored, had not accounted for the therapeutic aspect of housing. We had no idea. Over the past 10 years, we expanded our universe, if you will. The first pie chart shows the total nights we were providing, both in shelter nights and in housing nights, three-quarters of which were in 2001 were shelter nights. We were providing 175,000 nights of shelter and housing combined. Well, we expanded our universe. We made the pie bigger. And we made it bigger by focusing more on housing. Now, in 2011, without building a larger shelter, mind you, we're serving far more people than we ever have before. But thanks to housing, we're helping humanity flow through the shelter more quickly, more seamlessly into housing. And as a result, we're enjoying greater capacity at the downtown shelter. When I first started 10 years ago at the shelter, every winter we were busing 200 men nightly down to a provisional shelter in Midvale. Last winter, even though we served more men than ever before in our history, we did not bus one single man down to Midvale, a more effective model. I know I'm talking a lot about production and capacity, and it's very mechanical. Believe me, it's love-based. Now, sheltering 7,000 people annually, 183% increase over that decade, 777 people nightly, again, a 66% increase, but most importantly, 748 people nightly, 144% increase. We haven't hit our mark yet. We need to do better there. We need to do much better there. If we can double that, then we're gonna be hitting pay dirt. A housing focus model with case management. We're up to 15 housing case managers. We had to do a lot of tailoring.
A lot of people who were doing other jobs had an opportunity to become a housing case manager with us or work elsewhere. It was a little bit of hardball, loving team, working together. People made the transition. Palmer Court. Fate smiled upon us. We had an opportunity to purchase a hotel. We were actually, my management team and I, we were out trying to broker in the community to find somebody to buy this property that we knew was for sale and convert it into permanent housing with supportive services. We reached out to some different funders and some different developers. The developer said no. The funder said yes. Road home, why don't you do it? We'd never undertaken housing development before, but everyone's help, we converted 185,000 square feet into a beautiful, on 6 acres in downtown Salt Lake City, into 201 units of permanent housing with supportive services, Head Start on site, and we're very grateful to have this opportunity. Over 300 years worth of shelter nights consumed by the cohort who moved out of shelter and into this housing unit. So we're very grateful for that. For every 75 people we move out of shelter in that cohort that are in that small 12% group, we can serve about 1,400 people over a 24-month period with the beds vacated as a result of their departure. Thanks.
Thank you all very much for giving us these overviews. You've heard a little bit about how each of the organizations operate. We're going to have some time for questions, and I'm going to start the questioning with maybe an overview question. Our session this morning is addressing chronic unemployment and homelessness, and what I'd like to do is ask each of our panelists to share with us sort of a multi-tiered question here. What are the key metrics that the funders that you have worked with have looked to you to measure your success? How have they measured your impact and your success? And describe the relationship, particularly with the funders that you have worked with that have made the greatest difference for you to reach the success you have. All of you have been doing this for a number of years, so you've worked with your key funders. And what has made the difference in your becoming successful, and what are the key metrics that they are looking to you to be successful?
Well, we started with a very obvious one. How many people are completing the program and graduating? Then how many people actually get a job? You know, is there any fall off between those who disappear between graduation and actually finding a job? And that is a difference between 100% and 78%. They want to know how much money they're earning, so that's what we calculate. They also want to know how many of them are actually staying on the job. And we are close to an 80% retention rate. With those who actually get a job, they stay on it for a year, and we have some who reemploy. The other metrics we've just begun measuring is what is their earning capacity in the first year. And we've calculated, oh gosh, I don't have the numbers in my head, and it's not in your packet right now. But if you multiply out what each of them are now earning, it's multiple millions when you add up all of them that have gone through the program already. Mm-hmm. It's staggering. So what's the difference that they are then contributing to the economy as opposed to what it would actually cost for them to go back to prison? And that one I do know because we've got it in there. I think it's $18,000 a year to incarcerate a prisoner in Texas. You know, we have other numbers then for, you know, the average homeless person costs the taxpayers $17,480 a year. Those are the kinds of things that we're looking at. So what's the difference between, what's the payoff? If you invest this amount in the students that we have, what do they actually produce mm-hmm. as then tax-paying individuals as opposed to tax-consuming individuals? Those would be the major ones, I'd say.
And what type of funding have you received over the years that has been the most catalytic, the most important to you, that has made the difference to your organization, that has brought you to where you are today?
Well, it's all privately funded, and it's, I mean, every dollar counts is all I can say. I mean, we did this on a wing and a prayer because there was nothing like it, and it's very labor intensive. You need a lot of staff to be able to make it work. We have had a couple of very generous donors who have done a very big match challenge to the community. So this year, between the two of them, we have a $300,000 matching grant option. So anybody who wants to give this year who is a new donor to the Work Faith Connection, they will match, they'll match it. So that, I mean, that kind of thing has been very helpful to be able to go to people and say, all right, you know, we need you to get on board. We've had people who've sponsored an entire class. We've had people who, of more modest means, simply pay for one student to go through. But the kind of funding that helps us, honestly, is the kind that comes from someone who also becomes a champion of this and wants to become involved. We have some who are sending their grandkids over to volunteer. We have some whose wives are coming and writing birthday cards to all of our graduates. And those are the kind of people who are really, I'd say, are not just important for us at the organization, they are experiencing the joy. One of the things we do is allow everybody, donor or volunteer, the option to come to our graduations, and they get to experience the actual joy themselves and hug the graduates and hear their stories. Because part of this is not just about getting them on their feet economically. It's about relationships. It's about changing hearts, and it's about integrating people into a community where they are people with dignity and with value, and to actually be able to love them in that kind of a context with the people who are supporting the organization or who are volunteering with them, it's mutually transformational. And that's the secret part of it that almost nobody knows about.
Great. Sister Mary?
The metrics that we use are how many people permanently break the cycle of homelessness as defined by being housed 18 months or more. How many people have job, and that's a 95% rate. We're very happy with that. How many people have jobs that were, again, chronically homeless, living on the street, and education. We also measure people's education. And then, of course, are there's more money in people's pockets? We measure people's income each year. So I'd say they're the four, you know, indicators. In addition to on a city, on a public accountability. We take a census every 3 months, how many people are living on the street. And here's, this has gone up and down, but here are the three things. In the early, when we first started, there was a year where not one woman was living on our streets. We targeted, there were 85 women living on the streets. We targeted those women by name over a 3-year period, got every single woman off the street. There was no more women living on the streets. That was in the 90s. I can't say that today. Also, there was a time in 1997 where there were 854 people living on the streets of Center City, Philadelphia. And there was a lot of, I won't even go into all the politics around that, but there was a lot of hoopla around that. The tension that was built up between the business community and the people that were homeless community resulted in a reduction to 200 people in the year 2000 living on the street. 854 to 200. Awesome. That was so awesome. But now, again, with the economy, the numbers are creeping back up. So we do both public accountability, but also organizational accountability. That would be the, you know, that catalyst gift. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd have to say that first gift given by the Conley Family and Foundation, $100,000, see what you've done with it. We've done about over $100 million in equity. We have about a $16 million operating budget when you consolidate all our financial systems. So in terms of money, like, that was a pretty good gift, pretty good investment. I think they got a good return on their investment when you look over that. But also how housing is an economic multiplier. We just had a study done by eConsult, part of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and they show how the development of affordable housing, like the development of any housing, is a huge economic multiplier in our city. So, you know, good for that. And we're just received a very significant gift called the Middleton Partnership, which this family will match housing development dollars. We intend to develop a lot more affordable housing, and this family is talking about a 10-figure gift that they will leverage and challenge others to be a partner with them. They'll match it dollar for dollar. So that's a pretty good gift tip.
Well, many of our metrics are probably very similar to Barbara's. We're looking at retention rates. We look at employment rates, income, what their starting salaries are when they leave our program, and we track our students after post-employment. I have to tell you that we've we're actually in the midst of reevaluating our metrics. We discovered, as we looked really closely at the metrics and what the trends were that we were seeing, that chances are we had a tendency to look at how many people we accepted to the program and then compare them to how many graduated. Well, in our business, we know that just because you got accepted doesn't mean you show up day one. And so we're adjusting those metrics now to make sure they are more realistic measures of exactly the impact of our program, looking at the retention within the program, also looking at the difference between employment upon graduation and employment after 30 days. We're discovering, for instance, that we can have an entire class that's fully employed at graduation day, but something sometimes happens in those first 30 days, so that we have retention issues that we need to be examining. So revisiting those metrics, questioning those old assumptions is actually a very helpful exercise to us to identify where we need to focus more of our energies. We're also working on a program right now with a local community center that provides us with our case management services to actually measure the economic impact of the program on the entire family, measuring the family's economic status before entry, after they complete the program, and then for some time thereon. So we're not just looking at just wage rates, but actually looking at overall economic impact of the program. In terms of transformative gifts, I have to say that there have been a number of community funders that have come forward for us in critical times. Our program's only 13 years old, and we've gone through a tremendous growth rate as an overall organization. We talk about 13 years ago, the first day we sent out 64 meals. Well, right now we send out 3,000 a day and growing. And it is those funders that have come through for us as we have had to ramp up our program each time that have certainly been transformative. But that being said, we have continued to analyze the funding mix that comes into our program to make sure we're not over dependent on any one sector, that we're not overly dependent on grants, that we're not overly dependent upon corporate sponsors. And that has helped us continue to operate and not have to perhaps make some of the very, very difficult decisions that many other programs have had to make and to meet community needs throughout the recession. And perhaps of those funding, it is the sustainers, the funders who come back and support our program year after year, not always looking for something new and exciting and to change the program, but to nurture the program as it continues to move forward in an orderly way. And that sustaining funding has been very important to our success.
I just want to add one more point. Two of the most influential funders in our private funders in our organization always ask me the same question when I meet with them: how well are we playing with others? How are we collaborating specifically? I know my peers are being asked that same question too. It changes the dynamics on an interagency level as a result.
Thank you very much. I'd like to just draw a couple of common themes that we've heard this morning. We all know, we've heard this morning from our panelists that there's a great deal of partnership and collaboration going on with all of them. They're not doing it alone. They're doing it with folks within the communities. Most of them are using a wraparound or a supportive services model where they're not just delivering a singular aspect. They're using a strong supportive services, whether it's a faith-based or not. It's very strong supportive services. They have, whether it's character building or calling it individual attitudes, there's a desire on the parts of the individuals to reclaim their lives. It's a strong basis for the model that they're using. They're also using metrics. They're using metrics to measure their own success. The funders are using it to measure their success. And more people are presenting themselves. As we've heard, the economy is driving some of that. Whatever is there, organizations that are very successful, these are exemplary social services organizations, but they are presenting the models that are saying many, many people are coming to them. So if they're having this capacity, everyone is having the capacity. So I'd like to thank all of you for being here this morning, and keep up the great work. And thank all of you for being here.